We are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3729 of the Survival Podcast. It is Wednesday, September the 10th, and my head's still somewhere over the Pacific Ocean, but I'll do my best for you. I'm excited about this episode. This was actually supposed to happen like a month ago, but one of our guys piked out. Now, he actually had something come up and he couldn't be here. So I've got actually a twofer today. I've got John Pugliano, who you guys all know, and then Dylan Allen, who many of you know, because he's been around the community forever. He's also a professional in the nuclear power industry. And then the nuclear industry is something that John, as a financial guy, has followed very, very closely. And we're going to talk about the resurgence and the return of nuclear energy. And there's a few different things driving it, but mainly like, well, we need it, right? There's nothing else that will do what it does. And by the way, it's not 1965 anymore. It's 2025 and all the hysteria and hype. I mean, I grew up, I remember Three Mile Island. Not well, but I remember it. I remember the movie The China Syndrome. I certainly remember Chernobyl and the world was going to end. I remember Fukushima and the world was going to end. I remember the hysteria around Fukushima. We were already doing the show by the time that happened and everybody freaking out and buying iodine capsules and Alex Jones saying that babies were going to be dying in Nebraska in a year or whatever. And none of it ever came to be. It's not that there are no concerns or worries, though, but here's the commonality in all that. First one's a movie. Throw it out. The other three, these are all plants, and I'm sure Dylan will speak to this, you know, designed by technology developed in the 50s and 60s. And I've talked to several people in the industry, and they say when you go into an active nuclear facility today, you literally walk into 1966. Like, it's 2025 outside, and you go inside, it's 1966. Turns out we've actually had advances in technology and capabilities since 1966. It's true, including in the world of nuclear energy. You know, like all our subs and aircraft carriers in the Navy that float all around the ocean, they're all nuclear powered. I think if we can put a nuclear device on a ship that people live on, surrounded by ocean, and do that safely, we could probably do it on land and do it a lot better than we did 60, 70 years ago. We're going to talk about that today, why it's coming back, why it needs to come back, and why this is the time, whether people want it or not. We'll do that all in just a moment. Before we do, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day, number one today, is canineacademy.us, where you can learn to train yourself to train your dog. Get on over there. This is run by one of my good friends, Joel, and Joel's just an awesome dude. Our dog that we have now, Belle, our Mal Shepherd Cross, she actually came from Joel's other business, Fortress Canine. Awesome dog, awesome guy. And, you know, the thing about training dogs is it's not really that hard. The key is the person has to not treat the dog like a person. You have to treat the dog like a dog, and that's not a bad thing at all. And you need to learn how to do that. If you get over to Joel's site, again, canineacademy.us, you can sign up for the problem-solving library for free to get a taste of it, see what it's like, check out the other courses. Check it out today, canineacademy.us. And if you would use the link on my website or the banner on my blog, I'd appreciate that because of an additional deal that I have with Joel. Next up today, Biltong USA. Hey, my payment for sponsorship just showed up yesterday in the mail from Anton at BiltongUSA.com. You know, it is a box of Biltong. I actually take product in return for his advertising because it's so damn good. You want to check this stuff out. I first learned about Biltong from an author named Peter Hathaway Capstick in a book that I read by him called Death in the Long Grass. And I started making it myself. That would have been back in the 90s. Anton's commercial product is the first commercial Biltong I've had that actually tastes like Biltong. I'm not saying nobody else's does. I'm saying I haven't had it. It's also very affordable for what it is. It's awesome, and it's made the right way, the authentic way, the way it's been made in South Africa for hundreds of years. He also has some other really cool stuff. The Drewworth sausages are great. So on the Calabanazi. So check out Biltong USA today. And with that, I want to bring our special guests on. And we've got John Pugliano and Dylan Allen. Welcome, guys.
Thanks.
Yeah, great to be on.
All right, guys. I'll let you guys decide who starts. Can both of you just kind of give people a little bit about your background and how you got into what you're doing today?
Age before beauty.
That's John.
I guess that's me.
Yeah.
I think most people know I'm a member of the Expert Council. Been in the prepper space, I guess, a long time. I'm prepared more than I'm a prepper. Just raised that way as a kid. Served in the military, been in the corporate world and industrial sales and development for a long time. But the last, 15 years or so, I've been a professional money manager, run my own firm. And today I want to be giving you a perspective on really why I've been extremely cynically optimistic about the economy. And it really all has to do with nuclear energy.
Cool. And so I'm Dylan Allen. I was also in the military. I thought I was going to go drive some submarines around, hurt my knee back in OCS, and ended up designing and building them, which is where I probably the best injury that could have ever happened. I landed in the only place in the Navy that wouldn't court-martial me for saying, why are we doing that? That sounds stupid. Let's do something different. Spent about a decade there up in DC and then had a chance to come home, back here to central Mississippi, trying to build new plants for a utility. But the economics stopped working, for my utility. And so we paused that project, did a lot of big stuff around the utility, had a chance to, as nuclear started coming back around as the in vogue thing, to lead the efforts at that utility for their advanced nuclear program for about 3.5 years before I jumped out, gave Jack yet another reason to be a jerk, jumped out and started my own thing into doing a consultancy now, and having just a blast trying to help it move forward across the country and the world, because as Jack said in the lead in, we do need this technology.
So, and again, I'm going to let you guys hash out who speaks when. It'll be fun. You guys can knife fight or something. But I'm just going to throw the questions at you. You guys like work that out. Let's start off with, I do think a big part of why this is coming back around is, one, just because we need it. And I think there was a lot of people that understood that, looking for an excuse or a legitimate reason that we have to do it. But a big part of that right now seems to be AI and AI data centers. I also would say, if we're going to do what they say we're going to do with electric cars, and that's a big if, it's the largest two-letter word in the English language, we also need it for that. Right now, if 50% of the U.S. vehicle fleet was electric and everybody came home from work and plugged their car in, it would just fall over. It cannot mathematically work. I don't care how many people at Axios write articles about time of day charging and bullshit like that. It's not doable. But when we start, every time somebody runs effectively what is a Google search, a couple dozen GPUs spinning at the equivalent of mining a shitcoin, like the power drain there is extreme. And when we start using it for real world applications, which is beginning to happen, the power demand exceeds the power delivery capacity. So is that in your guys' idea, like why it's different this time, or is there something else driving it too?
Yeah. And let me jump in for a second, and then I'll let Dylan dominate on the technical side of things.
Okay.
And this gets back to my cynical optimism. I haven't been this excited about the economy for over a decade. And it gets back to exactly what you said, Jack, in terms of there is no way. I mean, the bottleneck, the limiting capacity right now going forward for everything, whether it's electrification of transportation, whether it's Bitcoin mining, whether it's artificial intelligence or automation or reshoring of manufacturing, all that stuff, it is all going to happen. It is already all happening. But none of it's going to happen unless there's more power, number one. And that's why I think this time it's real. But getting back to kind of set the stage for this whole thing, we're back to the future. You know, you talk about going into a power plant and being 1960s. I haven't been in a power plant like that, so I can't say. I'll defer that to Dylan. But from a financial standpoint, that's exactly right. And, I think in the 1970s, our country went off track in a lot of areas, right? Societal, militarily, industrial policy, and energy policy. Everything went off track. And we are, these 50-some years later, finally have a second shot, which, oftentimes you don't get. But we're actually getting a second shot to make up for one of the big errors we did, which was not to establish our nuclear power plants. I think it was 1972, 73, Nixon, as part of creating the EPA, he was trying to put in deregulation features, like a lot of like what Trump is talking about today to streamline nuclear power so that we could be totally energy independent. And the plan was we would have 1,000 nuclear reactors by the year 2000. But that was kind of his NASA space shot. You know, Kennedy had done go to the moon by the end of the decade. Nixon wanted to be totally nuclear self-sufficient by the end of the century. And we got about 100 reactors or so. We never got anywhere near that 1,000. But I think we got a second chance at it. And there's nothing better in terms of not only capacity of producing it, but the cleanliness. I mean, all the people that talk about global warming and climate change, if they really cared about that, they'd have been promoting nuclear energy for the last 30 years.
Yeah, I'll jump right on top of that one. You were talking about the demand, Jack. Like if there's usually most of the places around the country, there's 10 or 15, maybe 20% margin at the peak of like the peak demand compared to what's actually available to run. The time of use stuff, it works for a little bit, you know, but you can't make everybody charge at night. You can incentivize them to, but they may not. And we could legit break the grid if there's too much penetration of electric vehicles and things like that. Data centers, Dominion, the utility over in Virginia, put out a notice last year that said, hey, look, if you're over 100 megawatt load, that's, a good sized data center, but if you're over 100 megawatts, the queue's full till 2029. Sorry. Like we can't provide it. We can't interconnect you into our grid.
If I want to build a 100 megawatt data center right now, anywhere in the country, basically all the utilities are going to say, Tough.
Yeah, and some have more than others. You know, you can still do that. But here I'm in Mississippi. My old company serves Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas. And they're putting in some. Meta's putting one in down the interstate about 2 or 3 hours, and Amazon's putting one in about 10 minutes away, like a $10 billion investment. But we're also like having to build new power plants, and a data center doesn't want to run just when the sun shines, right? It wants to run. I guess we'll keep going while Jack's gone. Can y'all still hear us? Okay, cool.
And I can hear you.
And YouTube out there, can I get a comment? We lost a Jack. All right, cool. We're building new power plants, and if you want to have a power plant that runs during the day and during the night, when the wind's blowing or not, the only options you have are natural gas, coal, and nuclear power. For all the audience that's been here a while, Jack's from, spent a lot of his time in Pennsylvania, his family's from there. And what happens in Pennsylvania, you rip off the top of a mountain and get that coal to the plant. It's a huge thing you have to deal with. Trains full of coal, mountains that used to be mountains that are spent coal mines. So from a like Mother Earth perspective, nuclear uses fewer resources. It's just a lot fewer resources that we use. Less concrete, less space. You don't have to build up the transmission grid to bring other things in. So really the only two options out there, the most effective options for providing power are natural gas and nuclear. So if power demand is coming up, you're either going to build natural gas or nuclear, and you are constrained on natural gas to – do you have actual methane available? There's a utility that my company's been talking to. They're looking to add gigawatts of power in the next 5 to 10 years, but the current natural gas infrastructure doesn't support that, right? You have to, and so they are actively looking at building nuclear power too. It's really the only two options for 24/7 reliable power if you discount coal. And I don't think that we're going to build coal plants again in this country or really around the developed world because there's just better options. You talked about the 60s versus modern, right? When you walk in there, it does feel like you're in the 60s, but I'll say a lot of my work in the utility was doing effectively surgery on those nuclear plants where you go in and you pull out a 20-year-old turbine and you put in a brand new turbine or a pump or a valve. And so there's a corner of that plant that's brand new or, 5 to 10 years old.
Yeah.
The concrete, it's old. And the casing of the turbine, it's old. But, I've been in and around all of these plants and there's a ton of new stuff in there and we modernize. But these brand new designs can take it to another level. We have the technological capability to operate these things remotely if we wanted to. I don't think we can get the NRC to accept that risk, but we might, and it's possible. So now it's a, you know, if you've got all the money in the world, what's the next problem?
Energy.
Well, government.
Oh, right? Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah. I have been listening to you for a couple of years.
Yeah. I mean, government is the overriding problem of everything. But when I look at resources, and I think this is probably why John's so excited, like there has never been a time when a human civilization has thrived when energy of the time, so what was available at the time, was not abundant and cheap. When you have abundant and inexpensive energy available to a society, great things happen. And when you don't, well, we tend to like stab each other and shit like that. I mean, it's just historically speaking, fact.
Well, and now too, right? I mean, you look around the world, the places that have the most energy abundance are the places that have the highest, you know, for whatever they're worth, the highest GDPs, the least amount of, the least chance that you're going to get knifed in the back over a steak dinner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, from a government
seat, but not a steak dinner.
From a government standpoint, one reason I'm optimistic there too is that there's a lot of money to be made in this, right? This isn't a monopoly where, you know, ExxonMobil controlled, you know, all the fossil fuels, and so they have their lobbyists. I mean, this is a free for all for money to be made across multiple technologies. So I'm very optimistic that this is going to happen this time around.
Yeah, there's a ton of different designs out there, and not all of them are going to be winners. All of them have something that they're still, you know, they're still working through a detail. It's not easy to turn a paper idea that is a complex machine into a real thing. Somebody commented a little bit earlier about it's a great time to go into nuclear. You can become an electrician in a nuclear plant and make $100K, right? Yeah, like electricians, pipe fitters. Another thing I'm doing for work right now is a supply chain study, and one of the biggest risks and concerns is a labor force that's out there.
Yeah.
You know, welders and electricians, those are the first two. And, you know, pipe fitters, boiler makers, carpenters, just laborers, right? Just moving stuff around, operators to drive cranes and equipment. There is a lot of work that is out there to be done, nuclear and otherwise, right? As we start to reshore industry here to the States, there's a great opportunity to go get to work with your hands.
And my estimation too, like Optimus robots will not be doing that kind of work anytime soon. Like just from my background in telecom and things like, I've got a crew, we've got to put in 1,000 drops for this office space. That header is a double header and we need to get a penetration through it that is out of spec. And robots can't do this, right? Like that's not.
Yeah, robots can do parts of things, but they're really good. They're really good at doing repetitive tasks.
Yeah.
Over and over again. And, you know, we're getting better at robots that can learn things and adjust. But on the scale of, like, are you going to be trusting a robot to move, to do a one-time move of a 800 or 900-ton piece of, you know, equipment and structure, a big module that you're lifting in and setting into place with humans around it, controlling it with ropes, right? Yeah. Are you going to – you want that experience. So there's the kind of definition in project management, it's kind of a unique thing. It's new and one time only. There are some repetitive things you do, but the likelihood that type of work, right, that construction work is going to be taken over by the subject of John's first book is highly unlikely.
Yeah, and start thinking too where the opportunities are not robots, but it's cobots, right?
Cobots, yeah, I like that.
Cobots. That's the next book. The cobots are coming.
Yeah.
The cobots are coming.
Again, you know, like we talked about a lot, no one's going to lose their job to a robot or to artificial intelligence. They're going to lose their job to somebody that's already using that.
That's right. So, like, think about think about the facial recognition stuff that makes, you know, the prepper and me nervous. All those things. Facial recognition, the ability of AI to see an image or a video and understand based on its training what's going on. You know, there's companies out there using like live imagery to say, hey, this person is not wearing a hard hat. this person isn't wearing gloves. All the things that we currently have, like people running around with safety folks saying, hey,
safety inspectors.
Safety Bob, right?
Homer Simpson's out of a job.
Right, Homer's out. So kind of thing, like how do you apply AI and machine learning and drone technology? How do you put those things together and reduce the amount of workforce that you need to do it better? You know, if I can use cameras and AI, there's a company that I was consulting with a year or so ago. That's what their whole shtick was like, we can replace most of the safety folks on a job site just with AI and you know, the tech's there.
Yeah. Earlier you were talking about new tech, and about the same time this comment came in, every data center will have their own SMR eventually. That's of course small modular reactors. Now, this is one of those things, like the first time it came up in an associated video on YouTube, and I was doing some research years ago, I was like, oh my God, we're going to have one in my backyard. And then I really quickly got the feeling that, like, but no one's really building them, and they don't really do anything, and they don't really exist. And it makes me feel like an awful lot of technology that supposedly the Chinese, the Japanese, your uncle's former roommate, cousin's former roommate developed. And then they show this, like, you know, montage of all this stuff, but it's all like AI driven or animation instead of a thing. Are these SMRs real? And are they real from a practical standpoint? Is this something that's actually coming? And if so, can you explain to people more about what they are?
Yeah, so they are real, and they are becoming realer. There's a couple designs out there that are actively under construction. So GE Vernova has a project under construction in Canada, up just east of Toronto, called Darlington, the Darlington New Nuclear Project. They're building the GE reactor. They're planning to build multiples, but the first reactor is under construction. And similarly, TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, has applied for a construction permit to build a unit, one of the GE units in Clinch River, Tennessee, which is basically Knoxville area of East Tennessee, very near, you know, right down the road from Oak Ridge National Laboratory, where nuclear kind of kicked off in the country. Then, you know, TerraPower, which is funded by they'll always say that's Bill Gates' reactor. I mean, it was originally kind of kicked off, funded with some Gates money. But that, you know, it's a different type of design that is being built right now out in Kemmerer, Washington. They are moving dirt. X Energy is another design, different type of reactor. They have a project going on with Dow, you know, the chemical company, to provide not just electricity but also heat for Dow's industrial processes at their facility down in Texas, near Corpus Christi, Seadrift operations. You know, you can look up any of those projects. Those are real projects that are moving forward. Some of them are still on paper moving forward, but there is real money being spent to move towards towards the reactor. There's also some demonstration reactors. There's a bunch of those going on. A company called Kairos put out a plan, you know, over a decade ago, and said, hey, here's our plan to get this technology to market. And they've been just hitting all cylinders, bang, bang, bang. And one part of their plan was, we're going to build a couple of demonstration reactors at small scale to prove out the tech, prove out the safety case, prove out all the things, and then we're going to go big. And so there was a recent announcement where one of their research reactors, they're going to be able to sell 50 megawatts of that power into the TVA.
Okay.
Grid, right? So they're going to be starting to make power, and they're talking about making that happen later this decade. You know, it's relatively in our face, right, in terms of large infrastructure investments, because big power plants don't happen fast. You can get if you had all the equipment available, you could build a natural gas plant in year and a half, 2 years.
Okay.
You start digging, that's fast, but you could do it. But the equipment's not all even available, because everybody's like, we need power. So everybody used to say nuclear takes too damn long to build. Well, now, you know, transformers are taking longer. Turbines are taking longer, even for gas turbines, right? So the lead time for this equipment to make this grid stuff happen is starting to take away some of the differentiation in nuclear.
What good is power generation if you have no way to deliver it? So you might as well build better generation, since it's going to take you time to be able to deliver it in the first place.
Yeah, that's right. And it, you know, and it is challenged. The economics of nuclear power, based on the way we've done it, are challenging if you're going to go build it new. And the way you model what you're going to go build next is, it's real tough. It's a net present value calculation is all it is, right? And so, and it's a very specialized one. They call it a levelized cost of electricity. That's how we've done it on the grid forever. But that means that your capital costs that you spend right now are very heavy weighted in the calculation. And the cost that you're going to spend in 40 years practically don't matter. So that challenges the economic modeling for nuclear, because you spend all the money now, and then your ongoing spend is significantly less than a plant that like needs a natural gas pipeline, right?
To spend
millions and millions of dollars a month on natural gas.
And that's been the problem with renewable energies all along too, right? It costs a lot of money to put in a wind farm or to put in solar. All that's an upfront cost where, you know, once it's installed, there isn't much cost to maintain it, but it's so much cheaper short term to put in a nuclear gas, you know, facility. Hey, I wanted to comment too on that small scale nuclear reactor. From an investing perspective, that's all the rage, right? Everybody wants to jump in and buy NuScale or Oklo. And those stocks have been skyrocketing. I personally, I'm too conservative for that. I stay out of that arena. I don't want to be on the bleeding edge of technology. I think there's plenty of opportunity to be made. You know, you mentioned GE Vernova, right? They're profitable. They have multiple levers they can pull for sales and profitability beyond just nuclear. So I want to invest in those kind of companies. I want to invest up and down the uranium supply chain, but with companies that are in business that are profitable today, not what may happen.
It will be tied to this no matter who wins, because I feel like this looks a lot like 1997.
Sure.
Okay? Like, everybody knew the internet was the future. But for every Google, for Amazon, for every broadcast that got sold to Yahoo that made people a bunch of money, there was 100 that printed stock like toilet paper, paid everybody in it, and then went under.
Right.
The Globe and whatever, right? Like all these. So it wasn't a question of whether or not the internet would be the future. It would be who was the winner in the melee. And just in search, like, people know Yahoo, right? I mean, old farts like us know Alta Vista and Lycos and Ask Jeeves and GoBot. And like, there was like seven search, and there were like 1,000 search companies that were all going to be better than Google. And turned out, whether they were or not doesn't matter, they lost.
They got crushed.
Right. So if you bought stock in that, you just pissed your money away. And I feel like when you look at all these companies building all this new nuclear tech, and there is companies building it, and they still may lose, and there's a lot of companies that can put a lot of stuff on paper and say they're going to do a thing, and they don't necessarily do a thing, Enron. I don't even think people, like, for all of the hype Enron got, people have no idea how connected that was to the bullshit they pulled with Blockbuster. Like, that was one of the big things that destroyed Enron, was they were going to create Netflix before it was available, and they were going to do it with Blockbuster, and it was all data. It was like, we have lots of money and we have lots of words on paper, but they weren't ready to go yet. So I think in all these like SMRs and all these other nuclear tech, yes, it will work. But I'm with John in that, but you don't know who wins. And in the end, I'd be interested in what you think about this, Dylan. I feel like somebody has to be like the model, or one or two different models for this, because this shit's expensive. And like when I was in data cabling, the whole goal was eventually that nobody would have a phone with a phone jack. Everything would be an RJ45 data jack, because that way any device that you brought in, you could, it was interoperable.
Right.
And there is a place for some interoperability because of supply chain issues. And also if everybody uses the same basic design in their system, then lots of people can make product for the industry. Where if everybody's specialized, you got to make your own. And when you're out of something, well, it can become impossible to afford to replace it.
Yeah. So I think there's going to be multiple winners. First of all, I think there's going to be a number of winners. I think there's going to be some winners that they're using our existing technology, you know, like, which is light, here in the States, we use light water reactors that are, you know, use uranium pellets, and I think there's going to be some winners there, right? Like I said, GE's actively building a couple of plants. There's plans both in Europe and here. People are talking to them to do other plants. But I think there's also going to be some winners in the kind of more advanced reactor space that use different technologies that we have fielded in some ways before, whether it's molten salt or high temperature gas, or a liquid metal, right? We've done all of those things before in some way, and we have these modern designs that are trying to make it way better. Because they offer different options, they offer different missions sets mm-hmm. that they can complete, right? We build submarines and aircraft carriers because aircraft carriers are really good at flying planes off their decks.
Yeah.
They suck at going under the ocean. I mean, they can do it once, right? They can do it once. But right, so there's a different mission set, and that's why you go do the thing, you build the specialized thing, right? For AP-1000s, like the one that they built at Vogel down in Georgia, right? I think we're going to build a bunch more of those. You know, the president said, hey, let's go build a bunch of them. I think those are really a pretty good deal if you're going to just put in power on the grid. But if you're Dow and you need, you know, 600 degree steam and you need millions of pounds per hour of it, why does it make sense to make electricity and then use the electricity to heat up water to make steam? Why don't you just make steam and go straight to it?
Hey, you want to make steam, look at the advances we've made in geothermal, right? I mean,
That's right. So the point is there's some of these advanced technologies that I think you're going to win. I doubt there's going to be 10 molten salt reactor designers
what I'm saying, right? Like,
yeah.
I know this is much lower tech, but like if you go back to the 80s, was it Betamax or DVD? Or Betamax or VHS. That's all that, right? And there's no doubt Betamax was better, but who won?
Right.
And I wonder if who wins, whatever that means, may have something to do with what I call the Kyle and Karen conundrum, right? Which is we also have to sell people on the fact that, like, it's okay that this is near you, right?
Yeah.
People don't understand transmission. Why can't we just put it, like, way out in the middle of the desert? Because
if you were trying to sell your
chances, you should have no opinion about electricity. I'm just saying, alternative or otherwise, if you don't know the most basics of electrical requirements, you don't get to talk about this. But here's what gets me. Like I mentioned, like the aircraft carriers and the submarines. Most of these people that would be, you know, chanting and holding a sign up, not near my children or whatever. If you said, hey, Karen, you just won a 3-week all-expenses-paid trip aboard a United States Navy nuclear aircraft carrier, they would hop their short haircutted ass right on there and enjoy their 3 weeks with our boys at sea. Right? Yeah. They wouldn't even think about it being dangerous. But the minute it moves to land, and it's probably higher end, newer, better technology, then I can't have it near me. And how do we get over that?
So I think we stop leading with the airbag.
Okay.
You know, if you were trying to sell your Challenger, you wouldn't say this thing has an amazing airbag and seatbelts.
Yeah.
You would say this thing is fast. It makes you look cool. The lady sitting next to you is pretty excited when you drive it fast. Yeah. You know, like that's how you sell the car and you say, oh, by the way, it's got great seatbelts and airbag. You know, if you crash it going 160.
Yeah.
In the nuclear industry, we lead with the airbag. We're like, it's safe, it's safe, it's safe, it's safe. It's like, okay, how about it uses fewer resources from the planet? Longer term, we can dig fewer holes and use less space and make a lot more power than we can with some of the other things that are out there, for powering the whole grid. But it's part of a solution, and so let's use some natural gas, let's use some nuclear, and let's get busy getting and focus on how we can do it better, right? We do have to tell the story. People, starting in the early 70s, people were getting scare tactics. I was watching a video earlier today and it showed like Ralph Nader talking about how, you know, scary it is, right? So Fukushima got hit by a tsunami that was bigger than it was designed for. The earthquake that happened over there, it didn't hurt the plant. The plant just said, oh, there's an earthquake that has exceeded the set point, at which point I'm supposed to shut myself down. So the ones that were operating just went, they were boiling water reactors. They pushed their rods up from the bottom, stopped the reaction, And then they needed to start cooling themselves. Well, when the tsunami came across and wiped out the whole area, it also took away, you know, their ability to get power from their diesels because there wasn't a diesel fuel tank for various reasons. But yeah, like God slung a real big wave at a plant, and sometimes you lose to God.
Yeah.
Right? Sometimes you lose. But even then, the disaster that was the tsunami, people dying from flooding, being washed out to sea, that was a huge, huge human crisis. you know, huge human crisis. Thousands and thousands of people died from a flood that came from that wave. Nobody died from the reactor accident that eventually happened a week later, right? Or almost a week later. And look, it sounds scary. Those of us that have been in the plants, it's some of the safest places you'll ever be. Everybody around you is focused on safety. Everything we do is focused on safety. We have PhDs running million count Monte Carlo analysis to think about things like, what if 2 feet of the pipe disappears? And you say, how can that happen? They say, it doesn't matter. What if it did?
What if it did?
Yeah. And so, and they call it the vanishing pipe, right? Well, the pipe, it's going to shear, cut in half, and you're going to squirt all the water out of the full end of the pipe. It's not going to be a baby leak. It's going to be a massive leak as big as possible. Go make sure that you're good to go when that happens. So telling that story, you know, how do you get that deep with somebody that doesn't understand that you have to make all the power at the moment you're using it, or at least have it stored up somewhere?
Yeah.
Like, you can't get that deep with the public. It's tough.
Yeah.
However, the public kind of, in the end, if somebody wants to go build a nuclear plant, they can just do it. There's not that much public resistance to it. It's kind of in vogue. It's more about making the economics work. And by the way,
it's much safer with a PVC plant in your town, right? I really think that we have been done a number on with this. And I think that, like, everything that did happen was just hyped to the extreme from an agenda standpoint. When Fukushima happened, I'm not saying it was a minor thing and not worth worrying about. Again, it was ancient tech. We probably shouldn't build nuclear plants in a place that is susceptible to tsunamis. That's probably a bad idea. And turns out we don't have to. But then even the radiation that was released, I remember how they were making a big deal about it. Some dude made an infographic and it was showing like how much radiation it really is compared to like an X-ray or a banana.
Yeah.
Right. And it was like, oh, okay. So this is bullshit.
Yeah. Right. Three Mile Island here, like the airbag.
Nothing happened.
Yeah. I mean, the airbag went off when we totaled the car.
Yeah. Yeah. But
everybody got out of the car and walked over, you know, to the Smoothie King and had a smoothie while the cops, you know, towed the sucker away. You got a tow truck in there and towed it away. Nothing.
Yeah. Happened. If it was a Volvo, they would be talking about how everything worked.
Yeah. Right? And so it was expensive,
right? You know?
Yeah, Three Mile Island was expensive, and it exacerbated the fear that had been being brought onto the industry for a number of years. But they are some of the safest places you could possibly be. There are very, very few deaths associated with the nuclear industry. There have been some industrial, like, look, when you're doing industrial work, sometimes, unfortunately, people do die. But it's like fell 60 feet off of scaffolding.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Not anything nuclear. Right. It's horrible, but it does happen. That happens across all industries. There are sometimes fatalities. That's why they track the metric.
Yeah.
But it is the absolute safest available power source that can provide you power all day long.
Okay. And public sentiment is fickle too, right? The agenda has been to be anti-nuclear. That is shifting. And there will be some kind of a crisis or something that drives it the other way.
Suddenly, they convinced people that modifying your DNA for a cold virus was the right course of action. I think they can probably convince those people that one of the safest energy technologies is actually safe.
When Karen's air conditioning goes out, she's gonna be all on board for nuclear energy.
Yeah, the challenge is if you wait till you can't charge your iPhone, you're up a Skip Creek, because it's, you're years away, right? You're years away. Even if you want to build natural gas, you're years away from a solution. So you have to start saying, you know what? My backyard's a pretty good place to be. I would much rather be closer to power sources than distant from power sources.
Yeah.
Because the way the transmission grid works is you've got to have a physical connection. If it wasn't going to kill me, I could climb on the transformer that's right outside of my house and walk along the wire, walk across another transformer to a bigger wire, you know, keep tightroping all the way to a nuclear plant or a natural gas plant. You have to be physically connected. Hey, yeah, vortex. I was like, I'm on TSP. I don't need to look fancy today. You are physically connected to all these power plants in a circuit. And, you want to be as close to that substation that's dropping off of the transmission grid as possible. And the closer you are to the power source, the less likely that that part of the transmission grid is going to break or open on you. And when power goes out and they're starting to restore power, you're kind of restoring out from the power source.
Yes.
Please, nuclear in my backyard, not in my backyard.
Well, and that's, and that whole sense of urgency is why I would expect a crisis in the near future, right? We've got to have something that definitely really tilts the scale. And you just look at the invasion of Ukraine. Prior to 2022, Germany was the most woke, you know, relying on solar and wind power and wasn't going to burn coal. They were going to get rid of
carbon-free, like 2030 cars.
And they had been kumbaya with the Russians for 20 years, 25 years.
Yeah.
The day Ukraine gets invaded, they start digging for coal. They built 3 offshore liquefied natural gas terminals in less than 10 months. Right, you can't build a doghouse in Germany in 10 years because of all the permitting and bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Right? They made it happen, and that's what's going to happen. I'm convinced that we're going to see some kind of an event, whatever it is, and it's really going to spur this need. And again, it won't be nuclear overnight. It's going to be natural gas first.
Yeah.
That's the logical conclusion. That's why, as an investor too, I want to own a lot of natural gas.
Well,
and we
have plenty of it here in Texas. I mean, we have.
Yeah, the trick is getting it out of the Permian, right? I mean, there's only so many pipelines. To John's point, how long does it take to build a pipeline? Can you get it permitted? Can you, you know, they got the gas in the Permian. You know, they want to burn it in Houston.
And remember, how do I say this nicely? I'm not altruistic looking at what's best for society. I'm looking at how does John make money.
Oh, I get it. And to be fair, like what we're talking about here is they don't care about the temperature of water in your pool, but they care about the temperature of the water in their pool.
Right, right.
And if they start to see this hurting them, all of a sudden their nonsensical woke agendas about windmills that we have to take the blades off of every 5 years and bury in the ground because nobody can figure out what to do with a giant hunk of fiberglass. That's, by the way, there's a fortune in that.
They grind them up.
Figure out something useful to do with those things.
One of the things they do, Jack, is they grind them up and burn them in concrete plants. And so to reduce the CO2, you go build a wind turbine, and then when you're done with it, you grind it up and you put it in a furnace and burn it.
See, when you said concrete, I thought you were going to say they grind it up and make fiberglass crete.
That's what they add the fiberglass into concrete. They take it to a concrete plant and burn it. Oh, Siemens Energy.
But they burn it. See, I was thinking more like grind it up and put it as a like a lightweight concrete. Like maybe that would be useful. Like somebody's got to figure something to do with that that's like environmentally friendly or something. But let's keep on the subject. Like a lot of these projects are like first of kind, and there's a lot of risk with that. Can you guys talk about, you know, Dylan from a technical standpoint and John from a monetary standpoint, how do we get out there? Because like I've been hearing about shit like thorium forever, and it seems like another one of those. It's like if it shuts off, it just shuts down and nothing bad happens, and it's all, you know, it's like running off of petunia farts or something. But where are they? So now we're talking about even like things that weren't even thought about when we were talking about thorium 20 years ago. And how do we bridge that gap from a risk and standpoint, from a financial standpoint?
Well, and look, that is a question that we are trying to actively solve in the industry. Look, if there's one thing the government is good at, it's at taking risk with other people's money, but taking risk, right? They built the nuclear industry to start with. That's what happened. They started doing all the enrichment. They started, plants like Shippingport. They said, this is how we're going to do it. And then they slowly transitioned that to private industry, and private industry kind of took the lead in the late 50s and 60s. And then, before WTF happened in really 71 or so, and we started adding regulations based on fear and made it take way longer to build a plant. So first of a kind risk, look, you figure out as much as you can on paper, and you figure out a lot of contingency plans. When I was on the design and construction team for the first Virginia class reactor for submarines, we ran into all kinds of things that we didn't expect because it was first of a kind, and we had made changes to a design, like a totally new type of plant. You run into stuff and you end up spending your Valentine's night trying to figure out a technical problem that comes. And so you work hard and you work fast, and we still have that capability, but all you do the best you can on paper, and then you come back at it and crush it working, 7 days a week when you have to solve those problems that happen. So, and by the way, I see a couple of y'all that are out there in the nuclear industry. Feel free to, I think my contact information will be in the show notes group. Please reach out. Love to make connections.
Yeah, definitely. All the stuff that we talked about, all the stuff they gave me anyway, will be in the audio notes on the other side. And on that, while we're talking here, there's all kinds of tomfoolery going on in the video today that you guys had outweigh. It's like 100-1 on the audio only side. You're missing it. You might want to come by and see this video. There's some fun being had with people today. John, do you have anything to add from an economic side of that?
Well, from a big picture, from a risk standpoint, be prepared to see a lot more government intervention and government risk sharing, right? And not just in nuclear, across the board. We just, in the last couple of weeks, saw the government take a 10% stake in Intel, right? They've gone to companies like NVIDIA and said, if you want to sell chips to China, great, but you're going to pay us a 15% surcharge on it. So there's going to be a lot of government intervention. Again, we're in a whole different era of the economy. Industrial policy is going to be a big part of it. So a lot of this risk that is going to happen, I think, is going to be made public and shared among taxpayers and such. From an investing side, again, I'm not going to go out and buy NuScale or some of these other companies because I think it's too risky. I mean, there's too much money to be made in the day-to-day products. Jack, you think back in your days with Fluke. I think they're owned now by Flex. Those companies are readily available. Think of all the interconnections, whether it's fiber optics or circuit boards or just regular old, copper connections that need to be made. Companies like Eaton or Honeywell or, we already mentioned GE Vernova. Vertiv, which is
Siemens Energy. I saw somebody, Lilly Farms Food, in the YouTube feed said, I work for Siemens Energy. Look, their gas business is blowing up, just like GE Vernova's, right? They're selling every turbine they can make. They're selling every transformer they can make.
Everything.
They're making it rain, but they're getting to the, hey, you have to get in line to buy a thing. It's not,
which is kind of what I was talking about before, about not being altruistic. This bottleneck in energy means that there's a lot of money to be made up and down the supply system because these big hyperscalers need power. These industrial companies that are, we've got industrial construction that is running at 3 or 4 times the rate that it has been for the previous 1 to 2 decades before the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
We're talking hundreds of billions of dollars building new factories, and not just data centers, but just factories, manufacturing things. That all takes power.
Where are the jobs?
Those people are going to pay for
your end, right? Like, we're building all this shit, and like unemployment's going up, and the job. Of course, it's being spun that Trump did it, but like apparently, like they lied about 900,000 jobs under Biden being created that weren't there. And you start backing those out, the economy doesn't look as robust as it supposedly was and no one ever believed it. So if all this is like running max tilt, why aren't more people working?
Jack, you mentioned before about electricians and welders, right?
Yeah.
I don't know any of those guys that aren't unemployed, right?
Yeah, I agree.
I know a lot of baristas and, English historians or whatever, Shakespeare
Southeast
majors.
Swahili dialect
yeah,
studies.
I don't know anybody that has a skill that's unemployed or unemployed for long, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, there's transitions, but even the coders and the programmers, and a lot of them are getting laid off, but the ones that are good are getting picked up. And there is a thriving economy out there. And again, getting back to the stock market, you say, well, I'm not an electrician. Well, you can buy stock in companies that are related to that. You're not a welder. You can buy Lincoln Electric, right? They make the top of the line welding equipment in the world, right? You can participate in these things, even if that's not your skill set. But if you're young enough to be able to retrain or starting a career,
do that.
Go do it, whether it's quote, blue collar or not, get a technical degree and skill.
The other side is I can import all the coders, programmers, developers, personal assistants, coffee schleppers I want out of like Mumbai, right?
Yeah,
I can't really import a whole bunch of skilled pipe fitters from Mumbai or skilled welders or skilled electricians from India, right? Like, so all this H-1B visa crap and all that is taking U.S. jobs, I'll grant it that, but the jobs that are in demand are not really, in my opinion, affected unless I'm missing something.
Well, we could import that labor if we chose.
And we will when we need it, right?
That's what the Emiratis in the United Arab Emirates, right? They just built over the last about decade, built four new nuclear units, first nuclear units in the Middle East, large power reactors in a long time, outside of kind of like Iran, right? So they brought in tons of labor, Filipinos, Indians, Pakistanis, they people from around the world, Americans, Canadians. It was like Epcot Center, over in Baraka. And it was effective. They were like, we don't have all of this capability we don't want to build up this capability as a nation. We want to build up the engineering. We want to build up this, but like, hey, just bring in the labor, build it, and then they can go.
Okay.
And it's been very successful. We could do that, but we have enough people in this country that we can adequately staff projects that need to get built.
Hey. See, I'm skeptical when I hear that because I think back to like my contracting days with MCI, and I remember this one project we were on. And we put in something like, there was like four of us, and we put in something like 5,300 pair of cables and wire wrapped. And we did all this work in one night, rack run back. And at the same time, there was another group of contractors on the other side of the terminal. And I don't know if they were Chinese or whatever. They were Asian. And there was like 12 of them. And they looked like ants. They were everywhere working their ass off, like the whole shift. And they left about an hour before we did. And we're like, they must have done a lot of shit because there's like three times we went over and they ran two cables and not 300 pair either, like two 25 pair cables, and they didn't even terminate them. And 12 people worked for 8 hours to run two cables and they all look busy. And I just wonder about that kind of import labor. I don't mean to be.
I think that's going to depend.
I just don't know that I trust that labor to be as good as we're told it is.
Think of this in terms of immigration, too, though. Over the last 50 years, we've had a very bifurcated immigration policy.
Yeah.
At the very high end, we brought in the doctors from India.
Yeah.
And at the very low end, we brought in the Guatemalan fast food workers, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody in the middle, or virtually nobody in the middle. I think going forward, that immigration is going to be the middle, right? We're going to bring in the welders and the rigging guys. There are skilled labor all around the world. You know, we used to call it a brain drain, right? When the smart people come in from other countries, I think we're gonna have a skilled labor drain where people want to come in from Europe, people want to come in from Asia that have skills, and the advantage to our economy is we won't have to train them. They will be They will be skilled, and they won't be. They're not coming in. They're not coming in to get welfare, right? They're coming in to work.
Work.
That'll be the key too.
And our skill. Really, yeah, if you're coming with the skill already, and you know that's we're going to need people. But again, I think there's huge opportunity for young folks. I couldn't convince my middle, and my middle was on the fence about maybe going and doing welding, going electrical. He's going into construction. He's going to learn how to schedule, how to build. You know, he'll learn how to weld. He'll learn how to do electrical. He wants to be out there running jobs, so he'll have to get out there and you know do the hard work
manager,
first.
Manager, superintendent type.
Yeah, because it's not just the welders, right? It's also the PMs and the people that understand the logistics of okay, I need a 30-acre laydown yard, and I've got to make sure that I can get to that piece of pipe when I need it. And here's how we're going to lay out the little things matter when every day is costing you $1 million, right? You really need to make that a dance of an industrial ballet. And so people that work with their hands, people that understand that work with their hands, that can help choreograph that ballet. And then, you know, finance folks that can understand how to help us get it paid for, because, you know, don't give that task to an engineer. It's not our thing, right? But the finance side is equally important to figure out how we most effectively pay for, what is a not inexpensive project. You know, $1 billion asset, multi-billion-dollar asset. It's a thing you've really got to focus on the finance side as well.
So on that, like even just with conventional power, there's been like major cost overruns. This is lots of money. Developing any of this stuff is extremely expensive. It makes me think of the time in my life where I was working with cellular carriers, and all we were doing, we were using algorithms and AI back in the early 2000s, and what we were doing is helping them figure out where they could simply not spend the money this year, just CapEx, deferrals, like was huge for them. So this is way more money than that. You know, this is way more money than, you know, AT&T upping its backbone in New York City. This is massive. So we already have that in power in general. How are these companies going to manage this and still take the risk in nuclear where they're not sure about the regulatory framework yet? Some places are deregulated, some aren't. And again, like I've read a bunch of shit about cost overruns in just conventional power development.
Yeah, so I'll take a stab at that and maybe John can jump in. But the, you know, from a regulatory perspective, look, the NRC is trying to get better. But the requirements have like incrementally been increasing for 40 years, right? And, or for 50 years. And, what risk are we not accepting now that we totally were okay accepting in 1965?
Okay.
Right? We don't have, you know, we haven't had an issue with a plant that was built in the 60s. You know, the Three Mile Island happened, right? But again, airbag went off. Everybody walked away, no scratches. So what we are accepting less risk without any actual measurable impact across the industry. It's costing more, but they're trying to get better. But they're getting better from this like ratcheted up level of regulation and like the concept of, hey, let's just, what if we just drop back to where it was in 69? What would that do? Would that, and that, that's like heresy, right? We can't eliminate 50 years worth of regulation. Well, why not? It was working.
Well, we can.
Yeah, we can.
I'm cynically optimistic. You know, we eliminated a lot of that in the 80s, and that's what spurred the growth for the next, you know, 20 years. Jack, to, again, kind of my optimistic side of it, we are taking the government out of a lot of it. I mean, there's a government partnership. I think it's a new type thing where the government's looking at how do they make money out of this. Mm. You look at something like Constellation Energy, which is almost an exclusively unregulated nuclear utility. They're teaming up with companies like Google and Microsoft to go restart things like Three Mile Island.
Yeah, I read that. Mile Island's going to run a Google data center is what I read.
Right. And so you've got this expertise going on. The government's kind of hands off. And then you look at things like what can get done. What has Elon Musk gotten done with SpaceX that NASA hasn't done in 60 years? Right. I mean, it can happen if
there are some companies
that let it happen.
There are some companies out there that some of the folks said, hey, Elon, let's go build a reactor. And he's like, nope. And they said, okay, see ya. We're going to go build a reactor. And so a company called Radiant Nuclear just, they're building a microreactor, and they're like, hey, we're gonna build this little microreactor. It's gonna be a megawatt, and our goal is to compete with diesel generators at $8 a gallon of diesel. Well, I don't have $8 a gallon diesel here in Mississippi, but they sure do on the North Slope of Alaska. They sure do in a lot of places. And so if you can go drop in an asset that runs for 7 years, they ship it to you ready to run, you turn it on, you build a little concrete structure around one end of it, and then you run it for 7 years, and then you move it. You know, they're going to build their first reactor. They've been building test units. They're looking to start up their next, you know, their first reactor in the next year or so up in Idaho. As are a couple of other designers that are also doing these kind of micro reactors where, hey, instead of digging a big hole and like pouring a lot of concrete, doing a lot of steel work on site and having a workforce that has to go there, Allo is another company. They're like, hey, we're going to build a factory and we're going to start stamping these things out and they're going to come ready to go. And, So, you know, will all of these folks win? I don't know, but if I could replace a diesel generator and the supply chain that's necessary to fuel that generator, you know, out in the northern Montana or anywhere away from a refinery. Cool.
Well, people that maybe are not, you know, switched on to the electrical space as a whole, what does a megawatt mean in a real world scenario, like households or like what is the equivalent of a 1 megawatt production facility using conventional, you know, methods?
I will assume that most people are still old enough to remember what a 100-watt bulb is.
Okay.
Okay.
Maybe so, not.
Maybe not. But you a 5-watt LED, right? Okay. But let's go with a 100-watt bulb. Okay. A megawatt is 1 million watts.
Okay.
So 100-watt bulb, you would need 100 times 10,000.
Okay.
So is that right? 100 times 10,000. Let me make sure I can do basic arithmetic.
Yeah.
You would need, you know, a megawatt could power 10,000 100-watt light bulbs.
Okay.
Okay. And then, so that's at any given second. It takes 100 watts. I can have 10,000 of them.
Yeah. It's not like a solar system where it's 2 kilowatts, but they mean under optimal conditions through the day. Any given second, you have a megawatt of power available on demand.
That's right. And so that's the how much. And then the over time, the way you buy the stuff is megawatt hours.
Okay.
So I ran 1,000 megawatt plant for an hour. I got 1,000 megawatt hours.
Okay.
And so in the space, when you're looking about pricing, that's the pricing that they're talking about.
Okay.
Hey, what's the cost, the levelized cost of it? I got to sell it for more than that to make money, right? So what is that levelized cost of electricity in terms of megawatt hours, dollars per megawatt hour?
And people that are off the grid or not convenient to be on the grid are paying large sums of money to generate that for – you know, you mentioned being out in the middle of Montana or somewhere. I mean, there are places that are using diesel or natural gas generators from a company like Generac, which, you know.
Generac or Cummins or any of those.
Exactly. Right? I was going to go with it too. Cummins.
Yeah.
These diesel engines, these natural gas type, off-grid type solutions are very expensive, but people pay the money because they need the power. And those are companies that you can invest in today because – trust me, Cummins and Generac are very profitable companies.
Well,
you don't have to worry about who's going to develop that next, you know, small scale nuclear reactor. You can invest in the grid today.
I don't know if y'all.
I think part of it is I don't care if it's nuclear or coal or wind or solar or anything else. Once the power is generated, moving it, distributing it, storing it is all the same. So we have a growth sector in nuclear, but then we have a growth sector in power that's probably bigger than nuclear by itself.
Electrification, right? The whole electrification trade.
How do you get power to people? That's
yeah. But what you something you said though. So like you basically think of it more like one of your water tanks out in the backyard.
Yeah.
Right? You got to have the exact same number of water drops getting dropped in from the power plants as you're dripping out at every second of every day. Okay. So you can't store it unless you build. I mean, you can store it. You can pump water up a hill like they do in Tennessee.
Yeah.
And they make reservoirs and then they drain it back out when they need to. Or you can build batteries, or you can build a thermal battery with, you know, where you heat up a thing and then take that heat later. But storage is expensive, and it just it helps decrease a peak. It helps move the peak of the what's on the grid, right? It's not the storage is just put it somewhere and use it later. Not you still need the
you still make it. You got
the megawatts to make, right?
I think the future of storage is customer premise. Even if it's not sufficient to run the customer premise for 24 hours, if it's 2 hours of reserve at every customer site, you're way better off than having that peak storage facility centrally located. Because if one thing goes wrong, the whole thing's fucked up.
Well, yeah,
John's Powerwall shits the bed. That's John's problem.
That's right. So from an electric perspective, like a battery perspective, I think that on-prem kind of thing works a lot. But from a, like some cheaper ways to store energy, like thermal storage, right? Nice. So if you're making power with solar or whatever the case you're doing, heat up a massive thing of salt or concrete or whatever the heck you know, there's many ways to do it. And it's kind of like geothermal, right? In that you're heating up a big rock or salt or something, and then you're making steam with that later when you need it. That's possible. And I think that at grid scale just works on, a whole heck of a lot better, you know, than batteries. I don't see those. I mean, there'll be some batteries, but it starts to make it expensive. When you look at the overall
component, it really is.
But the other challenge with that is that, you know, solar and batteries, what happens when you don't have that power? Like when the solar's gone and the battery is expended for until it gets recharged, you still have to have a natural gas or a nuclear plant to run. So you don't get any savings, and the cost of that backup generation is not accounted for in the economic models that say, hey, solar's the cheapest.
Right? Yeah.
Solar's not the cheapest if you also have to deal with the operating cost of the natural gas plant.
Yeah.
Because you're paying guys to sit around and wait to run. Oh, okay, well, it's 9 p.m. and go.
Yeah, turn it on now. A cold front came or a heat wave came.
And regardless of how you generate it or store it, you still need copper to transmit it, right? So, you know, things like copper mining, those are all viable investments, and there's a bottleneck for that stuff. That's why I don't know where copper is today, but I mean, look at the price of copper today from where it was, you know, six years ago.
Yeah. Copper, steel, concrete, people that do controls, valves, forgings, you know, there's
flow serve is a great
question. Right, yep. You know, crane's private, I think, but,
you're getting on that. All the HVAC guys, right? Whether it's Train or can't think of all the names right now, but right, HVAC, because all this stuff needs cooled, whether it's a data center, an industrial facility, electrical generation, we got to cool this stuff. So
that's
another great career field, by the way. We talked about welders and electricians. HVAC, they're printing money. And those guys, watch this too. Your local HVAC guy probably isn't there anymore. Remember how like you used to go to a local doctor or local dentist?
These
insurance companies came in and bought them all out. Wall Street's latest craze is going in and buying HVAC little mom and pop shops, and you kind of making like a
rolling them into a conglomerate,
chain kind of a deal. Yep.
The Walmartization of everything, basically. Yep. Like I can tell you, my pediatrician when I was a kid was named Dr. Carrier, right? And I didn't go to the doctor much, but I know his name. I'm sure time has distorted it, but I can kind of see his face and what he looked like. I would bet most people under 30 today couldn't tell you who their pediatrician was by name, right? Because it's just whatever doctor was there that day. And I think that is happening everywhere. John, though, I hear what you're saying about like from a investor standpoint at our level, like investing in the space, not the company. I get that. But we're also talking about nuclear. So at some point, all these utilities, these boards, et cetera, have to decide like, yeah, we're going to go with nuclear on this project or whatever. What is the thing that gets them as in, because they're investors too in a different way. What gets them over that threshold to say, yeah, we're willing to commit to this? Because
they're already doing it. They're
projects, right? I mean,
yeah, and Dylan has life experience at this. He can comment on that. I'll just tell you from the investor perspective. Remember, there's already about, I don't know, 98 or so active nuclear reactors out there. and they're owned by probably about a dozen or so regulated utility companies, you know, Dominion,
Exelon, Dominion,
yeah.
Entergy, you know, there's a number of investor-owned utilities out there.
They're on board because, you know, we talked about starting up Nuclear Island. I think when Microsoft signed that contract, they were willing to pay something like 4 to 5 times the going rate for regular electricity. Right.
Yeah.
That's why they did it with Constellation, because they were unregulated and they could charge whatever they wanted to for the electricity. So
the challenge, though, for them is that the nature of the business is not one of taking risk. Right. It's a very risk averse industry. Right. Never be first. Never break from the herd. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, they do.
Ah, now I understand.
Yeah, no, Microsoft is hugely behind it because they look, whether or not you believe carbon dioxide is bad for the planet, they do. And they have a lot of money.
Well, they also have a huge carbon credit scheme that they created.
No, that's right. That's right.
I've talked about this in unrelated but related, in that they have an open bid right now for more biochar than exists. And there's nothing for them to do with it other than write it off as a carbon. Like, they're buying it and giving it to, like, poor farmers and shit, not because they care, but because they built the system to be game that way. So they're gaming it for nuclear. Okay.
Yeah, but, you know,
they game it for everything, right? I've been to a geothermal site here in Utah that Google's a big investor in. And I'm not sure. I mean, it's geothermal, but by the time you add in all the other stuff they have to do, I'm not so sure it's any better for the environment, but they're getting credit for it. And, you know, and on that very site, just down the road a little bit, Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's company, has had a facility operating there for like 35 years. So, I mean, this stuff is there. It just hasn't been mainstream yet, but we're bringing it on because we just have a demand. We have an insatiable demand for energy.
Demand. Yeah. And you know, the challenge with the utilities is who's going to break from the herd first.
Yeah.
Because, you know, nobody gets fired for doing whatever all the other utilities do. Like, nobody gets fired for that. The way you get fired is you take a bet and go out and be first and run into first of a kind problems that cost more than you expected and, you know, start challenging earnings 5 years out. That's how you get fired.
That's where like an Elon Musk or one of those kind of guys come in and do it, right? They just
or Gates, right? Gates with TerraPower, right? And there are a couple of these companies that are funded effectively by somebody with a lot of money that said this is the right thing to do, and they're willing to take that risk. They think it'll pay off long term. You know, everybody says, oh, that's the Bill Gates reactor, the TerraPower thing. I mean, it's not Bill Gates directly, but there's some people are taking risk to go do things in a new and different way.
And risk is being rewarded, though. I mean, you look at NVIDIA, right? When I wrote my book in 2016 about robots, I mentioned NVIDIA in the book.
Yeah.
NVIDIA then, I don't know, maybe it was a $2 billion company. Like, what's it now, $2 trillion? The money is being made, right? People are paying amounts that you would have never believed before. You know, 7 years ago, NVIDIA was gaming, right?
Right. And now
graphic processes for gaming. And they talked about maybe we're going to get into autonomous vehicles. No one imagined then how big this data center artificial intelligence push would be. And literally, I mean, they are printing money.
Yeah. Or at least in the largest company on the stock exchange. So it's a crazy time to be in this space. We are trying to keep our heads about us and continue to focus on doing it well and in the way that it's been done for the last really going on 80 years now of nuclear power. We're also not used to like rah, rah. There seems to be a more palpable and real excitement now with Google putting money behind it. Amazon putting money behind it. Amazon has invested money for X Energy. Amazon has invested in X Energy. Microsoft is buying up existing nuclear megawatts from people like Constellation, but also, looking at backing SMRs and other projects, Microsoft, Amazon, Google, the biggest money in the world is.
Now, Facebook just did that big deal. It's not exclusively nuclear, but that big deal with the natural gas guys up in Pennsylvania. I mean, it's
right.
Again, it's real. And this, I don't know if we're going down this rabbit hole or not, but the other thing that's going to drive this is if we don't do it, we're getting that second chance to do something that we missed in the 70s. If we don't do it, what's China going to do? Right.
Well, not what are they going to do?
What are they doing? What are they doing?
They are doing right now. They're building plants on schedule. Right. They're doing it right now. I know, Jack, you are a lover of thorium. I love the idea of thorium. It's awesome. There are a lot of reasons I don't think we're going to do that here in the States.
Okay.
If y'all want to know what a thorium reactor is, go look up Kurt Sorensen. He's a great thorium teacher. He's some old school teaching people in a basement about thorium. But the point is, the fuel cycle for thorium would have to be established from a supply chain perspective. It is not well supported. And so I think we're going to stick with uranium, but there's a lot of things we can do there too. And there's more uranium than we need. It's not a limiting constraint.
We don't have to buy it from Nigeria.
Well, we are buying it. We're buying it from Kazakhstan. We're buying it from Canada. We're buying it from Australia. We used to buy a lot of it from Russia. We apparently don't like that now, but we might again like it in the future. Apparently in 2040, we can like it again because the ban stops in 2040.
That's a convenient date when I think about how, okay.
Yeah. So how much is our supply chain in the States going to invest billions of dollars to go create enrichment capacity if the ban ends in 2040, right? Well, we need it before then. We need that investment to happen. But if you're we're going to start taking enriched uranium again.
And that's with that industrial policy, though, that is where I think we are going to keep a core competency in things. We lost our way since the 70s where we hollowed out too much of that. And I think we are going to see legislation where either the government does it directly or, like Trump's talking about now with the Japanese money coming in, we're going to make some basic pharmaceutical facilities again. Dylan, you and I have talked about Centrus Energy. I own that stock. They're a nuclear or they're a uranium refiner. I believe enriching. The only private one in the world, right?
Yeah. So that Centrus is looking at, there's the kind of the big ones that are allied. There's 10X is Russian, right? But allied. So there's Orano, which is French. There's Urenco, which is based out of the UK and Germany. And it's a European conglomerate with a government state backed. And then there's Centrus, and Centrus is the American publicly owned, publicly traded company that's out there that has the potential to build out capability. Urenco has a facility out in New Mexico that produces the lion's share of domestic enriched uranium, but Centrus is looking at building out capability here in the States, and so.
And for a company like that, I don't think we can afford to let them go under, right?
I have the same belief. Look. There are some things that's socialization. Look, I am generally anarcho-capitalist. I've been listening to Jack way too long to not be. But we can't just hit the red button. We are where we are. So if we are where we are, there's some things that are better to spread out the risk of to the everybody that's served by it. And, supporting a capability here so that we don't have to worry about it going away. Think that's on the right track, but who knows? And by the way, Second Light Organic Farm, look me up. I want to talk to you. throwing out stuff about Kazakh uranium, and I want to talk to you after this.
It's funny. It's okay if Kazakhstan enriches uranium, but
they don't enrich it.
Oh, they don't enrich it. Okay,
they mine it. They send their mined material to somebody that converts it. From a solid into a gas. That gas goes to the enricher who spins it around in centrifuges.
Okay.
To split the 238, which goes out, the heavier stuff goes to the outside more, and the lighter stuff comes to the inside. And then once it's enriched, then you have to turn it back from gas into a solid or a liquid, depending on the solid. But, and then that gets turned into final fuel form, which right now is generally just little like pellets that are, you know, the end of, like the size of the end of your pinky, and you stack a bunch of those.
We didn't used to be afraid of this shit. I remember in grade school, somebody from the nuclear industry coming in, they had a little card, like a little blister card, and it had a uranium pellet. Now, obviously, it was probably like graphite or representative of a single uranium pellet. And this is like first, second grade, right? So I can't tell you what they said it was capable of powering over its lifetime, but it was a shitload, and that would have been like 1981.
Well, right, and that's still the messaging, right? It's like this little thing is like 100 loads of coal or something. I don't remember the exact number, but it's like multiple loads of coal, multiple gallons of oil or gas. So there's companies in all of that piece of the supply chain just to get the fuel from rock and dirt to like a pellet or however you're going to use it. Somebody in the chat was talking about UEC as a stock, Uranium Energy Corp. They just made an announcement this week that they're going to be kicking off conversion services, mining, milling, and conversion. So they're conversions where you're taking it from what you dig out of the ground and converting it into this gas that can be used to enrich it.
Yeah.
So there's an opportunity, and they said it's on a tear. There's opportunity out there from an investment perspective. And yes, UF6 is nasty. It's not but it is the process that we use. We learned how to do it, and we continue to do it. But mining, conversion, enrichment, deconversion, and then fabrication. So, I mean, there's plenty of folks out there.
What about waste? Because, like, all these processes, like, I think the concern about, like, the high-grade nuclear waste, like the spent material, is way overblown. There's not as much of it as people think. We have ways to deal with that. But one of the things that the antagonist against this will say is, what about all the low-level waste in the middle? Like, all the stuff, all that shit you just talked about, all of this produces certain waste products that need to be dealt with. Like, that's a concern people have. And unlike the nuclear plant's going to melt and go to China, like, okay, that's probably got some legitimacy to it. How do we manage that?
So there's not that much waste.
Okay.
There's really not. So all of the spent nuclear, I'll go with spent nuclear fuel first. And I'll go there second. Because first, right down the road from John, in Clive, Utah, there's a disposal facility that owned by a company called Energy Solutions. They're private, so you can't go invest in them, but Energy Solutions has this facility. A lot of the waste goes there, and there's really only one kind of major competitor. There's a couple of sites around the country. There's Clive. There's some stuff at Savannah River for some government waste. Hanford is some government waste out in Washington.
Is that site in Nevada? Did they ever do the site in Nevada?
No, they never did. We haven't. So that's for fuel. I'll get there in just a second. So, and then WCS Waste Control Specialist, they have a site in Texas, but there's not that many sites, and they aren't that big. Like, if you look on a map, you can go find Clive. You just go down the interstate out west from Salt Lake and look and see what's there. It's just not that big a place, and that's one of the largest facilities there is.
That's out by Dugway Proving Grounds for any Army guys. That's out that direction.
Yeah, and there's nothing else out there, right? They dig holes, bury it safely, and there is a ton. And Second Life points out there's a ton of low-level waste. There is a ton of low-level waste, but relative to coal fly ash, relative to mine tailings, relative to all of the waste streams of other energy sources, if you look at the whole picture, there's not that much waste. There is waste, absolutely. There's not that much waste. So now let's jump over to fuel. We don't call fuel nuclear waste for a reason.
Okay.
Right? We used to recycle. The French currently recycle it. You only use about 5% for the 4 to 6 years that any given assembly of fuel sits in the cooler. Once you pull it out and you put it in the spent fuel pool and let it cool off, and then you go put it in that cask, you only used about 5% of the usable energy that's there. And I think there is an option for month-to-month billing for those not watching on YouTube. Maybe not. That 4 to 6 years of usage, we could make the decision to go process that spent fuel, that used fuel, and go get more uranium out of it. There are also some usable chemicals and isotopes in that spent fuel that, as you're separating things, you can say, oh, I want to pull this out and go sell it, right? I want to go sell the zirconium. I want to go sell the xenon. I want to go start whatever chemical, you know, there's some marketable chemicals in that fuel. And then there's some stuff that you really just can't get rid of. Like it is waste. But if you collapse that down to things that they're in the market for, you reuse all of the things that will fission again, plutonium, actinium, the thorium, the uranium that's still left there. We can make the decision to use that fuel. So there's like half the 5% used gas cans just sitting around every nuclear site. That doesn't take up that much space either. Like all of the spent fuel from the entire nuclear industry's history in the States is all sitting in concrete casks on their site. So it's a resource that is yet to be tapped, but there are multiple companies out there looking. Oklo is a company that's out there. I can't remember if they're publicly traded yet or not. I think they are. They went public last year, 23. But Oklo is out there talking about, hey, we are going to go recycle the spent fuel, the used fuel that's on all these reactor sites. That releases a liability for the utility, right? And right now the government, like, the reduces the spent fuel liability. And it also provides a fuel source for Oklo. There's other companies out there that are not yet public. They're in early phases, but they're looking at marketing all of these chemicals that they can get out of spent fuel, and similarly recycling the uranium. So yes, there is waste and for every energy technology, and there are things that we can do by making simple decisions but the question is, does it pencil out, right? It's not necessarily economic yet to do it. It may be, but it hasn't been proven out. So what we're doing right now works just fine. There's literally plenty of space.
I can attest to this. I mean, coal, John grew up in Pennsylvania too, so he knows the waste there. And it's not just the damage the mining does. Like, up near where I live, there was a place called Hometown. There was this huge bridge we used to go rappelling and what's that jumping shit with the bungee jumping and stuff off of. It's about 400 foot to the bottom off this bridge. And as you look up the ravine from it, I don't know if it's still there, but back when I got out of the Army, it was still there. This giant pile of, like, coal ash from one of the power generations, they burned it. And this is not just like your run-of-the-mill ash. Like, it had all this toxic shit in it, and it was supposed to go somewhere, and then somehow it ended up there. When I say a pile, I mean, like, a New York City skyscraper, like, six of them together, like a mountain of this toxic shit. And, like, once they put it there, everybody's like, I'm not touching it. And the state's like, well, we want to get rid of it. But where do we put it? I don't know. And it sat there for at least 20 years. And every time it rained, all this, like, mercury, sulfur oxide, dioxins, all this shit was just washing out of it into the beautiful creek that ran through that ravine. Right?
Yeah. Like,
I guarantee you no nuclear facility ever has a waste problem that's as bad as that one coal plant.
But my grandfather lived next to it, literally next to a slag dump. And in Pittsburgh, we had the coal trailings and all that that came out of the steel mills. They piled it up, and it would literally be mountains. And I rode my bike through that. I played on it. I shot my .22 in it. I crawled through the creeks and found, you know, crayfish and stuff. And which is probably why I have all the problems I do today.
I look like I do, right? Like,
can I share my screen, Jack, and just show a picture? Can I just show a picture?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. I will make sure I don't screw this up.
When it comes
up.
On, I should be able to help you. But you have
those slag dumps where the sulfur.
Okay. Hope everybody can see this.
Let me get it up. All right, there you go.
Okay, cool. Can you all see the map?
Yeah.
Okay, this is Grand Gulf Nuclear Station. It's the closest one to me. It's like 70 miles down the road. This is the whole site, right? And for this is a parking lot in the kind of up in the top left between the red dot and the Riverland. That's the parking lot. So for scale, there's cars.
I'm going to switch this. You guys aren't going. You keep talking. I'm going to switch it towards nothing but this.
Okay, cool. So the parking lot full of cars, right? You can see for scale. If you look down and to the right of the cars, there's another little thing that looks like a little grid, and I'm going to scale in. Those are spent fuel canisters, right? And look, here's some trailers and trucks and stuff. For scale, this is all of the spent nuclear fuel that's being stored on site, and that station has been operating. It's the largest single unit in the country, and it has been operating since 1985.
Okay.
So there's just not that much. Like you can walk around this in a minute. Right? It's like here's a little warehouse. It's just there. Spent fuel is not a problem.
Well, what about the person that says this is a terrorist risk or some shit? I mean,
okay, yeah. So
they're gonna get in there and scoop it up and shoot it at you with a slingshot or something. I don't know.
So what I would say is, you try picking it up. Now you can go stand right beside that big concrete vessel. You can. There's a model named Isabel. She's Isodope on social media.
Okay.
That the location that's Port Gibson, Mississippi.
Okay.
Is where that was. But you can if you look on any nuclear plant, that little what you see that little grid, that's where they're storing their spent fuel.
Okay.
You can't move the thing without a massive crane.
Okay.
And when they do move, it doesn't move fast.
Okay.
It moves real slow. And you could move it fast, but you'd need a way bigger crane. And let's just say you aren't going to get a white box van full of Iranian terrorists rolling into the, you know, into the mall parking lot to come move this stuff. If you get
this
it
is out not of a Tom Cruise, one guy down a rope and he scoops.
Yeah,
it,
that, right? That doesn't happen, right?
And yeah.
So, and if you, once you crack the top on the, that, concrete box, you better be ready because now you're going to start getting doses that could be, that would be lethal, like instantly lethal, right? You don't want to be near that stuff, right? There is spent fuel has a very high dose, right? It will kill you dead and it will kill you quick.
Okay.
So who's going to get near it? The only people that can potentially do that are state actors that can make it themselves already, right? Like, but could Russia do it? Yeah, but we'd probably have a pretty good warning if we saw the, you know, multi-hundred ton crane rolling down Highway 61 to get to the plant. But we're afraid of it, right? It's a fear. And so we have to allay that fear, and we pay a ton of money in the nuclear industry for security, right? Because of this threat. You know, is there a threat that somebody attacks a plant and creates some? It's real hard to mess up and defeat the automatic safety features of a nuclear plant.
Yeah.
But you know, it's way harder to do that than it is to defeat the TSA and get a water bottle on an airplane. Right.
Yeah.
So the security is, we spend a lot of money based on the fear.
Okay.
And not based on the reality.
Look at even the nuclear reactors in Ukraine now that have been under attack, right? There hasn't been any,
And it's like, why do we think that Rosatom would actually they know what they're doing. They designed and built the reactors, right? It's not like those Ukrainian reactors when it was the Soviet Union, Rosatom was perfectly okay operating these things. Second Life's about right. Like you're getting blasted. You know, the point is we spend money on security for things that aren't at least in my heretical mind, not really an issue. Ain't nobody moving that concrete cask unless they're moving slow and very effectively and are taking it somewhere where they can process it.
Yeah.
They could fly a jetliner into it, right? Or a drone.
Okay, there's your other thing. Especially
even with that though, those are not necessarily in populated areas where you're not going to get the effect you would if it was in downtown New York City. So
what about the person that says that if we start putting these smaller modular type reactors, like the French have nuclear reactors in Paris, like in Paris proper. Yes. How you fly your airliner into that and you create basically a dirty bomb.
The industry actually now has to analyze. They have an aircraft impact analysis that they have to perform.
Okay.
That's part of safety analysis now. If you're going to make a change, we also have to, you know, does changing this valve from brass to copper nickel make us reevaluate the aircraft impact analysis? It's like, okay. What? No, but you know, it's absolutely nuts. The level of it's almost like the vanishing pie. It's like, no, if you want to crash an aircraft, and I don't want any aircraft to crash into something, but I would, you know, if it's going to hit a 6 foot thick concrete wall, or it's going to hit, you know, there's a lot more vulnerable places, and you aren't going to, if you hit it with a, you know, with an aircraft, you're not going to create an issue that's going to let radionuclides out of the core,
okay,
or out of the spent fuel containers. You should see those spent fuel containers, like some of the tests that get run on these things. It's nuts.
Okay.
I'd much rather not have an aircraft hit like a transformer.
You know, there are more vulnerable things to.
Think about the train derailments that are just carrying chemicals, right? I mean, those have killed a lot.
Pretty much have one of those a day, by the way, in the United States. Like, they're not all catastrophic, obviously, but somewhere in the United States, about once a day, a train goes off the tracks.
Yeah.
When the Ohio thing happened, I heard that statistic and I was like, no. And then I looked it up, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, it's actually more than one a day on average per year in the United States, train derailments.
Yep.
And some of the shit those things are carrying, like one of the Alan Booker, who will be on this show soon and will be at the workshop that you'll be at, John, he was involved in early cleanup efforts in North Carolina, and some of those guys were going into some of the sludge with like rubber hip waders on and coming out, and the boots were melted. And this is shit that's been laying in a factory for 30, 40 years untouched. So I do think that we have, if you're worried about chemical, nuclear, terrorism, all this stuff, like, we have way bigger threats than a well-run modern nuclear facility.
We have way bigger threats than a well-run old nuclear facility.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, look, for the entire history of the industry, we realized this stuff could be potentially very dangerous, right? It has to be well-controlled. And so a lot of engineers and a lot of scientists spent a lot of time and effort, you know, sharpening their pencils and making sure that things could be well controlled safely. It's safe for the workers. Look, the limits on the workers, that people that work inside a nuclear plant get significantly less radiation than somebody that works outside for a living, because they have all this concrete around them that's blocking them from like the sun and other background sources.
Did you guys know that the sun is a nuclear fusion device?
Yeah, so
you know
fusion, fission, very different, and the fusion industry is actually somewhat sensitive to calling fusion like nuclear.
Okay.
Only because it is so different. Like, it doesn't create a lot of the baddies like plutonium and, you know, iodine and cesium and things that could like be not healthy for you if you got it in your body. Right. It's a much, you know, so they're super sensitive to being looped in with nuclear because of things like one guy, Smiley, over here on YouTube said, you know, blows my mind. I thought millions died. Everybody's freaked out about it. And so, literally one of the ways to harness nuclear energy is freaked out about being associated with the other half because everybody's freaked out about it.
Yeah. I had no idea that anybody believed that anybody died in Three Mile Island. The hype that I heard when I was a kid was it almost was really bad, and we got really, really lucky, and we can't do this anymore. For those that are on the audio only today, he said, we lost John, he'll be back. This blows my mind. I thought millions died and total destruction with Three Mile Island. That, again, I've never even heard anybody. That's up there with, you know, the size of a hole from an AR-15 is like a basketball or something. Like, I'm not putting the guy down. I mean, you know what you are told. I never heard anyone ever tell me they thought somebody died from Three Mile Island? I guess it makes sense at this point.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it came out about the same time as the China Syndrome, right? I mean, like if you aren't into the details and your mind conflates this horror movie with, you know, a fear-inducing movie with truth, it's real easy to meld those two things together in your brain as to what happened, and the stories get passed on. And, you know, how often do you run into somebody that tells you something that's a story and not actually based in fact, right?
Yeah.
It happens. But facts matter, but that doesn't mean, just because they matter doesn't mean that there's not a long road to hoe to get the public into it. But what you find is that the communities around a nuclear plant are the most supportive of nuclear power. You know why? Because they all work there. There's kids all go to school together. There's less fear based on ignorance, because if you have a question about nuclear power, you ask, you know, somebody that goes to your church or plays baseball with your kids or whatever. The most supportive are where they build the last two, where they already had two, that, you know, Waynesboro, Georgia, they love nuclear power there, and they're proud that they have the single largest nuclear facility in the country with four reactors, including the shining stars of the nuclear industry, Vogtle Units 3 and 4. So.
Hey, to the comments about Three Mile Island, I was literally in my senior year of high school there at the time. I grew up in the other part of state, but I happened to be up there for a high school event, and I was within, I don't know, 20, 30 miles of Three Mile Island. Again, I survived the that as well as the slag dumps, and I'm still here.
I did see a question. So Crockpot Broccoli said, aren't two of the three reactors at TMI still operational? So they shut down TMI one, but there are, like, it's currently owned. I mentioned Energy Solutions earlier. They have a decommissioning project they own both two of the reactors. And the one that got destroyed is obviously not coming back into operation, but there are talks. It's called the Crane Clean Energy Center. You know, Constellation is looking at restarting that reactor. So, they can go work on that site. There are people working on that site right now. Renee Bukele has expressed some concern about NIMBY and leaking into the air in the river. There was a very small radiation release, but relative to radiation releases that have happened via other types of energy, so like coal, when coal fly ash got released, or, you know, there's significantly more radiation that has been released in other ways than what happened. Yeah, nothing meaningful and impactful long term happened from Three Mile Island.
The average person who had an X-ray this year got way more exposure than anybody or anything did from Three Mile Island.
Yeah.
Probably before through TSA.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I got my NADS radiated twice on my boat.
Flew across country, right? Or, you know, if you flew across country.
Oh yeah. That's the other thing. When you're in the airplane, like, you're just being bombarded with radiation.
If you live in Colorado, and I think somebody here's from Colorado, you know, if you live in Colorado in the mountains, you get more radiation than anybody got.
Sure. If you live in southern Utah, not too far from where I'm at, just all the nuclear fallout from the 1950s bombing stuff.
Admittedly, that's still Mother Nature. But, yeah, there's still, yeah.
I mean, the background radiation, there's people still getting exposure to that. Totally different topic, but it's a thriving community down in southern Utah. People still live there.
Yeah, Colorado Foothills said radon in the soil, right? So there's lots of sources of natural radiation, whether it's cosmic, whether it's coming from radioactive, rocks and soils around which we live. I mean, if you live in the mountains, generally, A, you're closer to the sun a little bit. There's a little less air protecting you. And B, you're likely to be near rocks and things that are,
right,
that are more radioactive than, I mean, I live on clay and dirt that, you know, used to be a river. Or the ocean.
I think we've established, like, the waste isn't the problem people think it is. The safety isn't the problem people think it is. And that's with our older tech. Aren't some of these new projects using things that actually produce less waste and have greater enhancements for safety?
Some, yes, and different, right? So like the X Energy design, right? And a number of other of these advanced designs are using this stuff called TRISO, which is, don't worry about what it stands for, but basically it's this little kernel of uranium that is surrounded in a way that it is meltdown proof.
Okay.
So instead of having to worry about how the plant is designed, like to stop all the things that could happen when the pipe vanishes or the aircraft flies into the space that the pipe vanished from, and you know, all of that. If you can prove that there's no way to actually get the fission products and the transuranics that are formed when something happens, if you can't get out of that little particle, then it reduces significantly the amount of things that you have to do in the plant design to account for all of that crazy stuff that might happen, right? If it can't get hot enough to melt, then it's meltdown proof. Then,
okay.
And so what do you spend money on? You spend money on pumps and valves and concrete and all the things when you're building it, right? And again, if you can reduce that capital cost at the beginning, but that particular, some of those designs, they do generate a more spent fuel, and you may not be able to recycle it at easily or at all. We haven't quite figured that out yet. So you may generate more waste, but you get the economics right. And so there's pros and cons. Like, we can keep doing what we're doing,
yeah,
and have a recyclable fuel, and or we can tweak it and say, this is so safe. I mean, I say meltdown proof. Some of the licensing guys will say, well, in the there's a 10 to the minus 30th chance that if the core found itself in a spherical configuration for 10 to the minus 4 seconds, we could have – it's like, dude, how's that going to happen? Well, if there was a cometary impact. It's like if a cometary
– have a bigger problem.
Right. Sit on the roof, as you've said many times, sit on the roof with your spouse, enjoy a bottle of wine.
Get your Lebanese rose wine and your cheese out like my grandparents did during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and watch the sky.
Watch it come. Right. Yeah. So we will analyze things to the point of just absolute insanity sometimes. But I will say for all intents and purposes, meltdown proof. There's pros and cons. You might generate more waste, but it's meltdown proof. Or there might be some risk of a meltdown if you follow this particular chain of events. It's a one in, you know, less than a one in a million, less than a one in a billion in many cases chance. But, you know, okay, which is more important, right? You have to weigh what is the waste volume, or is the absolute certainty of no meltdown ever? Like, what is the thing?
So all these advancements, and the term that I hear thrown around is like these Gen 4 reactors, these new safety enhancements. Are those part of what's convincing investors? And I don't mean like retail investors. I mean the people funding the projects.
Yeah. And the
is that part of what's bringing them on board?
It's early, right? It's early money, right? Which is taking more risk than your like typical investor that's buying a stock, right? Venture capital kind of at the front end, like maybe 1 out of 100 bets hit, PEs that are looking for things that are pretty solid bets and a pretty solid return. That's who's funding a lot of these things, or just private money, family money, like in some cases. But the idea is to start with the premise that like what makes the economics of this thing? And it's the capital cost and how much it costs to operate long term, right? Whether it's fuel. And so the capital cost you can reduce by eliminating the number of safety systems that you need to actually construct. And the way you do that is you create a technology that doesn't need it. The premise that a couple of these designs was built on is like, okay, how do we make the fewest ancillary safety systems necessary? And so, and they came, they said, hey, look, let's operate it at atmospheric pressure. So this stuff can't even go anywhere. There's nothing to make it leave the pot. Mm-hmm. Let's use this molten salt. Let's put the fuel just dissolved in the salt. So it's already liquid. There's no such thing as melting it down because it's liquid. It is melted down, and that's the design of the plant. And it can't boil, like it's not going to boil because the temperature at which uranium boils is like very high. Well beyond.
That was like, the whole China syndrome. Like if it melted down, then the core would sink into the earth and go all the way, which
so
none of this makes sense. Though it could have done something, but I guess it can't do anything now.
Yeah, and
the idea that it was going to go to China is like my brain hurts because I understand gravity, and
but it'll just dissolve at some point. At some point something will be hotter than it, and it'll just dissolve
like magma. Said there's a lot of shit. If you're on the audio only, you're missing it. A magma.
Anyway, so these advanced designs are offering opportunities to make the economics work out better and be used in different ways than just electricity, right? So there's a whole effort by the Electric Power Research Institute, or EPRI. They have a whole effort called the Advanced Nuclear Technologies Group that's looking at this nuclear beyond electricity. Like, how else can you use it? We know we can spin a propulsion turbine on a submarine and an aircraft carrier, but that's still just making steam and spinning a turbine. But we can also just directly use the heat that is made, whether it's steam or whether it's salt, but whatever the case may be, to heat other things. And so it's actually really, that's what's driving a lot of investment. Like, how can we use this technology source? And it's being driven from both sides of the aisle too, right? So whether you think carbon's bad or good, it's still a potential option to reduce dependence on natural gas, which is at some level a finite resource. It may not be finite now, but you have to get it here. It's hard to move around. You do have to build pipelines. It's a perfectly acceptable resource for now and for the near future, for the rest of my life. Yeah. But, seventh generational thinking, the less Mother Earth we can use to get the same result, the better, right?
Yeah. So,
and the fact that all this has been pioneered by the military for all these decades, it is how technology usually works, right? It starts oftentimes in the military, whether it's satellites or GPS or whatever, and then it gets into the civilian population. And again, we've just taken 50 more years to develop this than we should have. But we've been in the military, now we're going to civilianize it. And it's going to be better, right? The internet is better than anything DARPA came up with when they had it. And it's going to be that way with nukes.
And look, they're doing that. The Defense Innovation Unit, DIU, has got this thing out for microreactors. And they've, there's a bunch of companies, BWXT and X-Energy. And I will mess it. Somebody from the industry is going to come back and throw a dart in my skull for forgetting their company. But, they're competing to say, hey, look, we want to put some microreactors at facilities, out in the middle of nowhere. One that comes to mind, I don't know if this is on the list, but like Diego Garcia out in the middle of the Indian Ocean, right? Like, how do they power that place? I mean, it isn't a Harry Potter wand. There is a logistics chain associated with powering that facility.
It's not a jelly bean field. I mean, and it seems like there are a lot of places like that. I never really thought about it. That they could be test casing these things, right? Like, everybody got upset recently because they said they wanted to put one on the moon. I'm like, if we're going to have a colony on the moon, we're going to have nuclear power.
That's going to be a thing.
That's how it's going to work. And if a nuclear power plant exploded, worst case scenario on the moon, you wouldn't even give it a square root of F. So just chill. Like, there is this like fear-based BS that, like, I guess it's 66 decades of hype.
Yeah, and it's hype, and there are reasonable there's reasonable answers, but it's difficult to have a nuanced, reasonable discussion. And I am not saying there are not challenges to the technology and things that you have to engineer and things that you have to deal with from a waste stream perspective. Right, there are things that you have to deal with, but what I am saying is that there are reasonable solutions. And it's just hard to have that conversation because most people don't even know how their light switch works.
Yeah, yeah.
Much
like
less.
There's all these people that we're going to run the whole world on solar panels or whatever. They don't know what impedance and attenuation is. Like, I don't even want to talk to you. I'm sorry. Like, you don't get if I don't get an opinion on abortion because I don't have a uterus, right? You don't get an opinion on electrical engineering because you don't know the most basic fundamental reality of like how power works, right? Like that's a lot bigger. But are there people saying, bring it, let's go? Are there communities saying, hey, we want to do this? Like, we have backyard. We hit that pretty good. But even as we were hitting it, I had a couple people in the comments, but I still don't want it near me. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but you got to approach Tennessee.
Let's go.
People don't want 5G, right?
Yeah.
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 But, you know, like you go to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and they love nuclear power there, right? The whole community runs on it, right? That TVA corridor, very nuclear friendly. The people around the Vogtle plant in southeast Georgia, they love nuclear power. They're very proud of it. The people in Mississippi who live near Grand Gulf, very proud of that facility and happy to be there. And it makes jobs and tax revenue and all the things that, like, if you want a job and you live in Claiborne County, you can go get a job at Grand Gulf. There's always something that's getting hired. You might be working in the workshop, the inventory. You might be working inventory. You might be welding. You might be an electrician. You might become an operator. They're always hiring for operators. You might be a security guard. There's 600 people, and they're retiring they're retiring every day, right? There's somebody retiring.
A couple years ago, at one of Jack's workshops, I gave a presentation about strategic relocation. Jack, I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, I remember.
The point I made in that was, if you want to live in a rural area and have a well-paid career,
Southeast
go
US.
Near a power plant. Go live by a power plant and get a job there.
Like, you know, I went carnivore back in 19, and I buy cattle here and there. And like one of my buddies that works up at the Arkansas nuclear plant that Entergy owned, he's like, man, if you ever need, I got cattle, like, let me know. I mean, he's raising cattle on the side. You can live out, you know, live on land. And you're at work a lot. You know, you're working a 40-hour, sometimes a 72-hour-a-week kind of job. But there's jobs. There's real jobs in the industry. And therefore, how do you sell anything from an economic development perspective in a community? Jobs. You know, that's what the politicians care about. It's what it creates community.
And like we talked about before, China is going there in a big way.
Right.
And so we have to, right? It's a matter of, it's a national security imperative. Both national security is just industrial. We have
all of the things that you need the energy for.
They seem smart though, John. It seems to me like they went all in on coal and they made tons of power generation. Okay. Now we got some breathing room. Now let's go build next gen.
Right.
And I think the path here should be nat gas to that, because coal's nasty. I mean, John and I know better than most. Coal, I remember my grandfather coughing up black gunk in the 80s, and he hadn't been in a coal mine since the early 60s, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know how bad it can be. But you have to have some way to get there. Like, to build all the shit for the new nuclear plants, that needs energy, right? Like, you have
a lot of diesel.
Produce stuff. So, like, are we going to fix our issues with, like, not just rehoming manufacturing, but, like, production of raw materials? There's a lot of shit, even if we build it in the United States, we can't build it without China.
Right. So,
like, how does that factor in all this?
Yeah, so I've been doing a supply chain study that was funded by, you know, an NGO, and I won't talk about it here, but we did a supply chain study. And you go look, like, so a ton of our raw materials are coming from overseas. Some of those are coming from friends. Some of them aren't. There's a couple of things that lithium, seven, it's an enriched lithium product that's one of the only sources is China. And maybe that's okay. But it's a supply chain constraint that we depend on a nation that some would say is adversarial to us. And so how do we fix that? I don't know. Nuclear grade graphite. There's some graphite available. Not a lot of the Gen 4 designs use it. And so where are we going to get it? There's not really much of a, there's not a domestic supply of nuclear grade graphite to speak of yet. Although a lot of the companies that need it are looking to try to build that up. I even heard one company was even talking to like a somebody that could machine the stuff was actually in the gun industry. And that's, they found this company in the gun industry that could work with graphite, and that's their initial supplier. So let's see, who is destroyed by a power plant being built? And I think the answer is nobody. I mean, a local landowner, right? There might be, but usually the power company does a pretty good job about paying folks for their space.
Just for your reference, because you were talking, I was responding to Renee here, and this is what she said with that. I don't think that fear for our future is a bad idea. We see people's lives destroyed by power plants being built in their backyards. It is what the documentaries are saying.
So I will just say,
I would let the documentaries part off, Renee, just to, if you wanted to make your case, because the documentaries are not necessarily our friends. And what I'm saying to that is, like, you know, like you were alluding to, Dylan, local landowners or something, eminent domain. Okay, I agree with that. I think eminent domain is Satan. I understand that. But that's true of, like, every bypass, every new highway. Like, that's a separate problem with everything we build going there. So if you want to fix the eminent domain issue and make people do fair offers or whatever, I don't know how we're going to solve that. But
my old company cut down the tree on which my deer stand sat on the right-of-way. At my uncle's property, and they didn't do eminent domain. They made a fair offer.
Okay.
Except they didn't replace my deer. I mean, I had to put my deer stand back up.
Okay.
But the point is, there are some, they make a fair offer, and a lot of people make, and some people say no, but I don't want to sell it, period. And I do have morally, I have an issue with the concept of eminent domain. And if you're loud enough with enough neighbors, then my former company made some decisions to reroute some stuff because they knew these people are going to be a big enough pain in the rear that we're going to go about 15, 20 miles around, instead of going through. But to say that it's bad to be that a power plant destroys people's lives, I think is, definitely a reach. And I think that is based on fiction.
I think it's based on too many TV series written by millennials.
The people I know live near power plants, have jobs there. And I mean, literally a mile down the road from Grand Gulf. And I talk about that one because it's literally, I know I have cousins and I have family that's worked there forever since it was built. There's a pond and a little neighborhood community, you know, everybody's got a dock and fishes and they come out and hang out and have dinner. And it's less, you can literally, while you're fishing, you can see the water vapor coming up out of the cooling tower. You're so close.
Yeah.
And it's,
well, by the way, everybody thinks that's smoke. It's steam.
Yeah. It was water vapor.
Yeah.
I'll be nerdy for saying
that. Yeah.
It's a cloud. Look, I told my kid when he was like three, he said, Daddy, what do you do? I said, well, I keep the lights on and I make clouds. And he kind of looked at me like, didn't really believe me. And one day he was sick. And so I stayed home with him while my wife was working. But I drove down to the plant because I forgot my computer. So I drove down there. And as we turned the corner onto the plant, he sees this, clouds coming out of the cooling tower. He's like, Daddy, you do make clouds. And there was not a holiday that went by that a fictional character was not. I mean, I was bought. He was bought and sold that Daddy told him the truth about everything when he saw that I really did make clouds. So
That's interesting. And now what Renee's saying is, and we're only going to case this so far, not building, running the plant makes people sick.
Yeah. And that's just,
How, like, again, we're back to the documentaries or Gasland, and they show the guy, lighting the gas on fire or something. Again, first of all, that's not a power plant. Second of all, that was proven to be a lie. Though there is some issues with some of that stuff, but there's also issues with like gas getting into groundwater where nobody explored for gas too, with fractures. Like, it's a natural product. I don't know. I've seen some real evidence of things like chemical factories and shit making people sick and destroying their lives. I have not seen jack diddly about power plants. Unless you want to talk about coal waste, because, again, I'm not going to argue with that. And that's not what we're talking about.
So, something to think about, too, though. There are trade-offs in everything, right?
None of these people ever want to turn their power off, right? Like,
Right. And we make choices. And I'll tell you, the world is a lot cleaner today than it was when I was a kid in 1960 in Pittsburgh. Right? say what you will, the world is a cleaner place.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And
when I moved to Jacksonville in the 70s as a kid, there was a bridge called the Hart Bridge, really high bridge that went over the St. John's River. We had, you know, paper mill manufacturing and stuff like that in Jacksonville back then. When you drove over that bridge in the morning, you had to roll your windows up, cut the vents shut to the outside of the car, almost hold your breath as you crested that bridge, and your eyes literally still watered like somebody hit you with like a light overspray of mace, and your lungs hurt. Right? That was the and when you looked at that paper mill on the other side of the river, blue. I don't know what the was in there, but like oil burn blue smoke poured out of that thing all day long. It's not like that now. When you said that, I had that memory of how bad it was there, how bad the air stunk, and it physically hurt your lungs to breathe it. That was, for a lot of younger people, you don't know where we came from. You really don't.
Well, and look, you know, to all the angst we give to the crazy environmentalists, they did a lot for this planet, right?
Agreed.
I mean, and that's where I'm when something starts to go political, I'm like, look, you can disagree or agree that carbon is bad. Can we all agree that planting a tree is a good idea? Let's do that. Yeah. Right? Let's figure out the 99% of the things we agree on and go do that. And nuclear power seems to be one of those things where we can all say, hey, this is a pretty good idea. And there's fear we need to deal with. There's education that needs to happen, and it's going to be slow because, again, we got to – There's a whole lot of ignorance, and I don't mean that in a mean way. I just mean there's a lot of ignorance to cure before we get down to the details of like nuclear waste versus spent fuel versus used fuel versus, you know, millions of people dying at you know, or thousands of people dying at TMI versus reality. So there's a lot of fear and loathing in Las Vegas over the Yucca Mountain project, right? Where better to put used fuel if you're not going to use it, reuse it? Where better to put it than in a hole under a mountain in the desert? Like, but you know, by the way, I just heard all stuff about, so apparently Charlie Kirk, for those just listening to the audio, Charlie Kirk got shot while we're recording this. Not sure that he is dead, but did get shot. So,
Little personal note on that. I've got an end to that event. I was supposed to be there today and would be had I not been here, Jack. So
I'm glad I was a piker and made us reschedule, Jones.
Yeah.
Save my life, maybe. Hey, you know, one thing too, and I'm going to stick on the side of greedy industrial capitalists. You know, industrialists are not inherently anti-environmentalist, especially when you think about the fact that waste is a cost. So to the degree that they can stop creating waste, they're making more profits. I've been to totalitarian / communist countries that supposedly don't have a profit motive, and they are much dirtier than anything in America. It's all this paradigm and most of it's nonsense. We live at a great time in humanity. It's a good time to be alive.
Yeah, absolutely. And whether or not Charlie Kirk died from the shooting, as an homage to him, nuclear power is the right answer for the future. Prove me wrong.
Yeah, yeah. This has unfortunately boosted my segment for tomorrow about some more concerning things. But let's kind of wrap up. Like, one of my big things that I've hit on this a couple of times, but now I'm talking specifically about fuel. Like, if we decide to do this and all our fuel is coming from Kazakhstan and being enriched in Russia, right? Like, to me, that's not really like to run your electrical economy on imports seems like a really bad idea. Now, some mitigation with nuclear is you could import a shitload and have a reserve for a long time because of how little it takes. But can we get to a point where we're not only doing this, but we're developing our own fuel, managing our own, like actually onshore all of it?
We can, well, maybe not onshore, but at least bring it inside the tent of our friends, of our, you know, our long-term and our long-term friends. So I think we could say that Canada is a friend, right? We're in no danger of Canada and the United States not having a relationship. I realize that there's been some headbutting in the last 9 months, but legitimately they're our next door neighbor. We're going to be okay. They're a huge source of uranium, and there's additional mines that could come there. There's the enrichment capability, both domestically and, in France, the UK, potentially Canada. Like, so there's uranium enrichment that can be either here, and there's plans for that, or in our close neighbors, and there's plans for that. Fuel manufacturer, you know, there's multiple companies manufacturing nuclear fuel here in the States, like facilities here, GE, Westinghouse, Framatome, and then other folks that are getting into the business doing different types, BWXT making fuel, like TriSo fuel, and there's other folks that are trying to do it. So the fuel, we can absolutely get there. I think we need market signals to make people invest to get them there. The pumps and the valves, some stuff, yes, some stuff is still offshore. You know, it is hard to manufacture some things here, but there are a number of things being manufactured in the States, and it's mostly paper that's a challenge, right? Like, we have to get people qualified to make a thing that is nuclear safety related from a quality perspective. But that's a thing where maybe we can accept some more risk and change the way we do quality, because the thing that they're making is perfectly good for an airplane that we're going to put 120 passengers on, but it's not good to be used on a power plant. Like, what are that? So those components, they're forgings, you know, so we are probably not going to make big, huge, ultra large forges like they used in the AP1000s, those big reactors. But the SMR scale forgings, there's capability here in the States, and there's a number of forges that are kind of trying to kind of get together and say, hey, here's what we can do. The rest of the stuff, you start to have to be local, right? The construction force has to be there. The steel, you know, how much of the steel is American made? How much is a raw, you know, the raw iron and other, you know, at pieces of stainless steel, and how much of that's domestic? Who knows, but it's possible, right? You need chromium and vanadium and all these things to make stainless steel. So to a great extent, I think we can build up a domestic supply chain, but there has to be a signal that says, you know, go invest money in a plant that's going to do something, right? It's going to enrich uranium, or that's going to go make additional forges or machine forges or whatever, machine a forging down into a finished component. There's got to be a market signal, and that's the place where we hadn't quite worked it out. I don't have an answer for you yet. I think, as John mentioned earlier, a government kind of kick to kind of just get the show on the road and reduce some risk for the market may be necessary.
Yeah, and we're living through, just in terms of supply chains, we're living through an incredible era. I mean, this is Cold War II, whether anybody wants to admit it or not. And globalization isn't dead. We're all too interdependent, and there are real comparative advantages, right? If there's something that can be done better in Istanbul, it should be done there.
Yeah.
But what we've let happen over at least the last 30, if not more, years is we've let too much be happening in China, not because they have a comparative advantage,
but
just because they haven't, you know, we've given them the advantage. And to me, that's what I think is going to change. We have identified them as an adversary, and we will still get things from all around the world, but we are going to do our best not to be overly reliant on China. Because if we do,
that's my bigger concern, other than importing stuff and importing anything, whether it's labor or material or resources, is importing from a single source. Like, one thing I always was mindful of in my business, if we ever got a business to grow to a point where we had one customer that was like half of the revenue of the company, I'm not getting rid of that customer, but I'm also in the ass of my salespeople going, you need to make them 20% of our revenue without cutting what we get from them.
Diversification.
I don't want any one customer being responsible for more than 20% of my total revenue, because then they start acting like a shareholder, right? They start having leverage over you. Well, what if I just take my business elsewhere? you know, and if they're 5% of your business, it'll hurt. But my response to that would be, well, good luck on your way out the door. But when I'm going to have to lay off half my workforce because I lost one customer.
Yes, Mr. Customer.
And suppliers are like customers in a way. And that's where I feel like we've gotten so dependent on China. Like China could have just went switch and like they would have their own problems with it. But like, oh, you don't need antibiotics. Oh, you don't need electronic components. Look at all these things you don't need anymore. Look, now you don't have them.
Or they could walk across and
eventually maybe having a conflict with these people.
Yeah, I mean, they could walk across and say, hey, you know what? We kind of said Taiwan's ours. We think it is. It's ours now. And then where are we getting chips? Right.
Yeah.
It's a risk. So the point is there is a capability to build up the supply chain, but there's people sitting on go like, hey, is the government going to help? Is the government going to help somebody else and not me? Right. Yeah. That makes my investment a bad investment. If I spend money and somebody else also spends money, but they get a 50% back from the government, or
if I'm a billionaire and I'm going to throw money at something, I want to throw money at the same thing the government's throwing the money at.
Yeah.
Because they have an advantage. And I want to win. I didn't go to the horse track and like, oh, that horse is limping. Let me bet on him. Like, no one will ever think to do it. Yeah, because he's going to lose. Right? Unless you know he's fake limping, right? You know?
That's why I remain cynically optimistic, though, right? Because the greedy, rich corporations that run the world – do that because they are the greedy rich corporations around the world, and they are going to be incentivized to build this electrical grid out.
Yeah.
Bottom line.
Yeah. No. Absolutely.
It's not a matter of when it happens or if it happens. It is going to happen. I'm convinced.
I'm equally aligned.
So we're at 2 hours and 15 minutes, one of the longer episodes ever. So let's wrap here. What I want from both of you is start out with what do you see the next 5, 10, 15 years looking like in this space from your each unique angle, and then tell people how they can learn more about you got your individual selves and what you do.
John, you want to go first?
Yeah, I just say so. In the future, I just think nuclear power is going to be the energy source. I don't know if that's 10, 20, 30 years out. It's going to go that way. In the meantime, though, I'm heavily invested in things like either directly or indirectly in nuclear and natural gas, because that's going to be the bridge to it. And again, no matter how you look at this, whether it's the hyperscalers, you know, the Metas and the Facebooks, Microsoft, those guys, or whether it's the guy that's, you know, welding or the electrician that's wiring this stuff, there is opportunity for everybody. And, you know, career-wise, investing-wise, again, I'm just super optimistic. I think we have a path to prosperity, and nuclear energy is going to guide that. Hey, as far as me, Wealthsteading Podcast is where you can find me, or my investment firm, investablewealth.com. Always happy to talk and hear from people from the TSP community.
Yeah. And so I think the next, from a more technical perspective, the next 5 years, we're going to go figure out a lot of things first of a kind and start to de-risk things so that people can make more informed decisions about the technology. 10 years out, we're likely winnowing down to get the winners and figuring out who the winners are going to be longer term, and from there, I say it's a log jam. Once we kick a few of these logs free and a few break through and successfully start moving down the river, the rest are going to open up and do the things that John just talked about to build out the economy that, you know, we went global. We were the reserve currency. That means we had to import a lot of stuff for years. It's time to change that, and to do that, we're going to have a prospering economy for likely my lifetime and our kids' lifetime, and there's going to be some bumps, but I think nuclear power is a huge part of the solution.
All right, guys. Well, I appreciate you both being with me. I've got websites and some stuff from both of you guys. I'll make sure those are available in the audio notes, which will go live. I'm going to say 45 minutes to an hour. After we wrap up, if you're watching the live. Thanks for being with us today, John and Dylan.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Jack.
All right, guys, real quick, I want to wrap up. For those that are listening and maybe didn't see what was going on with the chat, we got information just about 10 minutes ago that Charlie Kirk was shot. And I haven't seen the video footage of it yet, but it's legitimate. It happened. And the people that have seen what happened, he was apparently shot with a rifle in the neck. They say there's no way this man's alive. So effectively, a mainstream conservative influencer was just assassinated. And this is falling on the back of what recently happened with the Ukrainian immigrant stabbed to death on a train, and no one did anything to help her. And I actually said yesterday, we're reaching a very dangerous point in the simulation. If you want to know more about this, I'm not going to continue a show that's already 2 hours and 20 minutes in. But I was going to talk about this powder keg tomorrow for my segment anyway. And now there's unfortunately more fuel to the fire. My personal advice right now is be careful around large metro areas. And I'll leave it at that for today. But keep an eye on things. We talked about a very optimistic subject today. And I'm still very optimistic for the future. But that doesn't mean I don't believe that really nasty things can't happen in the middle. And there's been a lot of violence by one particular side of the political dichotomy in this country. And I've always said that as bad as that is, if the other side, which is generally far more peaceful, ever decides they've had enough, that it could be way worse. Because and this is my opinion. This is not a fact. It's straight up my opinion, but I believe it's based on fact. And that is that the left really likes violence, but I believe that when it comes right down to it, the right would be better at it. I don't know where this is going to go next, but and I'm not saying it's going to go anywhere this weekend. And I really don't think that it will. But this is something to keep an eye on. So if you want to know more about that, tune in tomorrow. Otherwise, like I said, Dylan and John's resources will be in the audio notes for today's show as I wrap up. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today and given how long we went. And the terrible news we just got, because it does sound like Mr. Kirk probably has passed and probably was immediately. I'm just going to, with some respect, end things today, and I'll catch you tomorrow with more. It won't be a live stream tomorrow, though, depending on what comes out, I may not do a podcast live stream, but I may do a live stream tomorrow to talk about some things. Take care, guys, and one way or another, I will catch you tomorrow. Just run you round. They said you should have a house. The American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.